Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Two unshakable images of Russia's Boris Yeltsin, one of the courageous leaders standing atop a tank in 1991, staring down the last dangerous gasp of communist power in a crumbling Soviet Union he would then dismantle. Another, 8 years later, of a weary Boris Yeltsin wiping away a tear as he became the first Russian leader ever to voluntarily give up power and begging as he went for the Russian people's forgiveness for his failings. Now, Yeltsin is dead and Russia is not what he dreamed of, but his hand-picked successor is in charge. Up next on Point, Boris Yeltsin and the Russia he leaves behind. In a moment, we'll be joined by David Remnick, New Yorker editor, who covered Moscow in Yeltsin's heyday. But first, joining me now from Moscow is Andrew Miller, correspondent there for The Economist magazine. Andrew Miller, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Describe the scene. I believe you are at the cathedral where Boris Yeltsin's body now lies in state. What do you see?
Well, outside there's a queue of a couple of thousand people waiting to get in, and inside the ex-president's body is lying in state. It's a pretty strange scene, I have to say. There's some weeping relatives to one side and a lot of TV cameras, and an honor guard from the Kremlin surrounding his tomb, along with a lot of Orthodox priests intoning some prayers and swinging incense. And you realize when you walk in there that actually Russia's never done this before. It's never buried a democratically elected president before in an Orthodox ceremony. So I guess the choreography is all pretty makes in a way. But it's nonetheless a pretty affecting scene inside the cathedral.
New, like much of Yeltsin's life after the end of the Soviet Union, we read that this will be the first funeral for a head of state sanctioned by the Russian Orthodox Church since Tsar Alexander III in 1894. That's a long interval.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there were state funerals, obviously, for during the communist period, but not in Orthodox cathedrals. In fact, this cathedral where the lying in state is taking place and the ceremony will be held tomorrow was knocked down by the communists. It was one of the main Orthodox cathedrals of Tsarist Moscow, and it was blown up under Lenin or Stalin, and the intention was to turn it into a palace of the Soviets, which was never constructed. In the 90s, under President Yeltsin, this cathedral was rebuilt. So it's a sort of fitting place, I guess, for him to have this lying in state ceremony.
Boris Yeltsin will not be buried in near the wall of the Kremlin, in Red Square, like so many other communist leaders. Is it known? Was that his choice?
Was it his choice? I'm sorry?
Was it his choice not to be buried by the Kremlin wall in Red Square?
I don't know whether it's his choice or not. I mean, where he's being buried in Novodevichy Cemetery is about the most prestigious place in Moscow to be buried. He's in pretty good company with Chekhov and Shostakovich and Khrushchev and even other Soviet and sort of pre-Soviet luminaries. I mean, I don't think the Kremlin wall would be an option, though it has to be said, for all the people who are queuing here to see his body, Yeltsin is not a popular figure in today's Russia. Russians are a pretty sentimental lot, and they're trying as they can, most of them anyway, to be diplomatic on the occasion of his death, but he is a deeply unpopular figure in Russia, Boris Yeltsin, and much more so than he is in the West, where he's remembered for the with the tank and the other reasons you mentioned in your introduction.
How has the press, which is increasingly under government influence in Russia, how has it handled the news of Yeltsin's death? What kind of depiction, portrayal, what kind of commentary have you seen?
Well, it's been very respectful. I was watching state-controlled television last night, and it was very respectful. Ordinarily, the 90s are portrayed in the state-controlled media, and indeed by the Kremlin itself, as a period of chaos and instability, which ended when Vladimir Putin, Russia's current president, took over from President externally in Yeltsin. But in this instance, most of it's been pretty soft and sentimental. There hasn't been scathing critique on television. We played last night an interview that was filmed for Boris Yeltsin's birthday last year. And he himself, in his retirement, refrained from directly criticising President Putin and basically stayed out of politics. And they've been pretty respectful in the last couple of days.
Unpopularity in the streets, respectful treatment in the press, and Boris Yeltsin lying in state there in Moscow. Andrew Miller with The Economist in Moscow. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
I'm joined now by David Remnick. He's editor of The New Yorker magazine. He has watched Russia, been one of our keenest observers of Russia for a long time now, was Washington Post Moscow correspondent from 1988 to 1992, the sort of the heyday of Yeltsin's time in the great transition there. He joins us from New York. David Remnick, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm all right. We're looking out to Russia and where it's traveled. We've got Vladimir Putin, of course, who was handpicked by Boris Yeltsin. Saying that under Yeltsin, Russia entered a whole new epoch, that he has bequeathed the state in which power truly belongs to the people. Interesting words from a Russian head of state. Your thoughts on the death of Boris Yeltsin, David?
Well, a lot of emotional and intellectual thoughts about this, because it was, but how it intersected with my life is of no great interest. But I think the idea that he put power in the hands of the people, and hearing Putin say this is kind of ironic, because for whatever strengths Putin may have, one of his severe weaknesses is his squashing of any civil liberties that grew up, however tenderly, under Yeltsin. And Russia is also a country that lacks politics at this point. However imperfect Russian elections were in 1992 and 96, and they were severely imperfect, they practically don't exist now. You have a second-term president who's about to face an election with no other parties in sight, who crushes all opposition, who makes sure the press is really castrated almost completely, especially on television. So there's a tragic feeling about this. However orderly and stable the state seems to be, it's a state that lacks the even rudiments of early democracy that Yeltsin was instrumental in providing. This is, of course, you know, with full awareness of all the horrible drawbacks of Yeltsin.
We'll talk about those. We want to just sit and meditate on this man, his meaning in Russian history, and where Russia has come since he gave up power. You were there when the big change was happening, David Remnick. Let's listen back for just a moment to that moment, that time that the whole world knows, August 1991. Here again is Russian President Boris Yeltsin. He's urging Russians, I guess this is shortly after he stepped off that tank, maybe it's the next day, urging Russians to celebrate the end of a coup attempt and the victory of democracy.
I call on all my fellow citizens, in the name of national unity, to begin work toward the revival and renewal of Russia, to the victory of democracy over reaction. And as we always say at the end in Russia, hurrah!
Boris Yeltsin addressing a crowd in Moscow in 1991. David Remnick, take us back.
I remember that very well. I was standing about 10 feet away from him. It was on the balcony of the Russian White House, which was the parliament building in those days. And it was after the coup had collapsed and Gorbachev was eventually freed from his, you know, his kidnapping. He was a hostage in Ukraine while he was on vacation.
And this coup or putsch was sort of the last gasp by hardline communists not to see it all slide away.
Exactly. It was really engineered by the KGB, above all with help from the top military leadership and the conservative wing, still predominant of the Communist Party at that point. And they pulled that coup off in August 19, 1991, in order to prevent Gorbachev from returning to Moscow to give a speech that would realign the Union into a more of a confederation than it had been, a looser alignment, and they wanted to stop that because they saw the country as falling into chaos, and they were obviously losing their own grip on power. And, you know, so the head of state is literally under house arrest in his vacation home, and what Yeltsin did was be the galvanizing force for the opposition to this putsch, which was backed up by columns of tanks and all kinds of arms, and really stopped it dead in its tracks on day one.
He was a hero on that day, was he not? I mean, Russians...
He was absolutely heroic. I mean, whatever we're going to... And we'll talk more about it, of all the corruption that he allowed to leak into the state and the mistakes made about the economy, and one could go on and on. On August 19th, 1991, he played the role of a heroic, courageous leader, and there's no way that can be taken away from him, and it had a historical impact that was and is incalculable.
And ultimately, much more bold in his moves than even Gorbachev himself, and we'll look at that. They were rivals on that day that he defended, maybe saved Mikhail Gorbachev. David, remind us of who this man was, where he came from, and the peculiar twists in the late 80s and early 90s that set him up to become the man who would dismantle the Soviet Union.
Well, there were similarities to Gorbachev in that he did not come from an elite background. Yeltsin came from the Urals, an industrial part of the Urals. Mm-hmm. His father was imprisoned during Stalin's regime, which is certainly not a unique experience in the history of the Soviet Union. And he became a Communist Party apparatchik in the Urals, in specializing in construction. And Gorbachev brought him, and he became the sort of regional Communist Party leader in his time. And he was brought to Moscow by Gorbachev to be the head of the Moscow City Party Committee, which is a rather powerful position. And he was on the ruling Politburo, a kind of junior member of the Politburo. And it immediately became clear he was of a different breed. He was not of the intellectual reform wing. He was more of a kind of populist reformer. And he would get on trolleys and go into stores and ask what the problems were, and really kind of man of the people sort, occasionally compared to almost Huey Long in the early part of his career, maybe an imperfect analogy, but that kind of feel to him. And then he broke with Gorbachev. They had a big blow up in 1987. He was kicked out of the Politburo and then made a comeback as an independent and became a real iconoclast, somebody who was a figure that in a sense was both with Gorbachev and also against him, by pushing him to go faster and faster in a political environment in which Gorbachev was getting it from all sides. And it was an incredible drama to be witness to, and that relationship between Gorbachev and Yeltsin, both the partnership, the opposition, and even the eventual political hatred, a kind of yin-yang relationship, was in no small measure an accelerating aspect to the course of events in 89, 90, and 91.
David, describe for us the different visions that Gorbachev and Yeltsin had of where the Soviet Union would go, of what its path ought to be, and ultimately the much more radical vision of Yeltsin.
Well, I think it changed over time, but the way to put it in thumbnail terms is that Gorbachev, at least for a long time, thought that he, you know, was working on the model of his old Czech friends from 1968, that you could come to a kind of reform communist position, or later on maybe a social democratic vision, without necessarily destroying either the Communist Party, but rather making it into either a reform party or a multi-party system. And later on, he certainly never wanted the Soviet Union itself to be broken up. Yeltsin was much more radical in his vision, thought the Communist Party was an unreformable institution that needed to be destroyed, needed to be, in the end, banned. And he, of course, acted almost on his own with the head of Ukraine and Belarus to break up the Soviet Union as an entity once he became president of Russia right out from under Gorbachev. This, of course, is after the coup. This is in the fall of 1991. Mm. They went to a hunting reserve in Belarus, the heads of Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia, and on their own, essentially, just said, that's it, the Soviet Union is over.
There's the famous story of Boris Yeltsin in the United States, I forget the year, walking into a supermarket in Houston and seeing the tremendous cornucopia of products there against the stark reality of what anyone who was in the Soviet Union saw as, you know, very often empty shelves.
This is a very common experience for these guys. A lot of them had never traveled to the West, or if they had, they had done so by, you know, coming to London or Paris or New York and staying in their embassies and getting a very sheltered, blinkered vision of these things. And it is incredibly striking in those days for somebody who thought that a life of privilege was the life of privilege of a Communist Party chief, and suddenly he's walking into, you know, the Grand Union or the AMP and seeing 47 different kinds of Cheerios and being utterly stunned. I mean, it was a kind of sensory overload, and along with it, a kind of romanticization of capitalism and the capitalist West, almost blinded by the light in their first go. Gorbachev had more experience abroad even before he came to power. He had gone on some trips and was, in a sense, more sophisticated about the world than Yeltsin was, certainly in those early days.
But for Yeltsin, this left him, in the reports from the time, just staggered. And as a man, as a populist, as a man of the people, thinking, this is how ordinary Americans shop, and my Russian people have nothing like this.
Well, that was just self-evidently true to anybody who experienced it. I mean, any tourist who went in one direction or the other could see the contrast. Russians would speak of, and everybody in the Soviet Union would speak of, equality in poverty was the state of affairs. You know, and we'll speak of, you know, the disastrous course of the press and civil rights and civil society under Putin, but it also has to be said that for a variety of reasons, including much higher oil prices, but also certain economic reforms, that you are seeing the growth of the middle class, not only in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but in many Russian cities today, and you have this phenomenon of a gigantic economic divide between this growing middle class and people who have suffered terrible privations, deprivations since the collapse of the old order.
Help us understand those 90s when Boris Yeltsin was in charge, when his popularity ultimately plummeted. I mean, we come to New Year's Eve, the end of the millennium, December 31st, 1999, and his surprise resignation. And you remember those words, David. He says, and let me quote just a little here, as he spoke to the nation, leaving power after...
Please forgive me, he said.
Yeah, I want to ask for your forgiveness for the fact that many of the dreams we shared did not come true, for the fact that what seemed simple to us turned out to be tormentingly difficult. Mm-hmm. I ask forgiveness, Yeltsin said, for not justifying some hopes of the people who believed that at one stroke, in one spurt, we could leap from the gray, stagnant, totalitarian past into the light, rich, civilized future. I myself believed in this, he said, that we could overcome everything in one spurt. It turned out to be too naive.
Well, I think you have to give him credit for some, by that point, some rare moments of absolute candor and truth and heartfelt rhetoric there at the very end. The drama of the 90s really is, it begins with economic reform, in which, he's exactly right, he tried to institute a radical reform plan to get the nation's industries and businesses and all the rest out of the hands of party leadership and into the private hands. But this was done in such a chaotic and ultimately corrupt way that he lost tremendous amount of support. People were enormously resentful that suddenly there was this new class, very small class of oligarchical leaders, and one discovered that this enormous change, this world historical change, was a great deal more difficult than anybody had anticipated, and power and riches had stayed in the hands of traditional people. The KGB remained in place, so much so that the next leader of Russia came from within its ranks. So that was one thing. The second disaster, and unforgivable disaster, was the beginning of and the brutal prosecution of and the ongoing war in Chechnya. There's just nothing good to be said about that.
A war that Boris Yeltsin thought would be quick and easy.
Exactly. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And there they are still in a really complicated situation all these years later, more than a decade later. And one could go on. There was an economic collapse in 1998. But the great gift to Russia that the economy has enjoyed lately is the high price of oil. Yeltsin
sure.
never had that. Yeltsin was, the price of a barrel of oil was a fraction of what it is now. And it's on that strength that no small part of the economy has flourished under Putin.
But the man who took the Soviet Union and broke it down, Boris Yeltsin, now dead at 76. David Remnick is with us, editor of the New Yorker magazine. He was with the Washington Post in Moscow in Yeltsin's heyday there. David, a lot of listeners want to join our conversation. I want to begin to turn to them. In Des Moines, Iowa, Jim is calling. Hi, Jim. You're on the air with David Remnick.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a comment and question for your guest.
Mm-hmm.
In 91, I was just getting out of the Army as an intelligence analyst and Russian linguist, and I had people ask me, well, what do you think's going on in Russia today? And at the time, I thought, well, there's over 150 real distinct ethnicities in at that time the Soviet Union that were ready to tear into each other's throats. At least that was my opinion just from listening to the radio conversations of that I was privy to. And my thought was it didn't matter who was in charge at that time with a breakup. You could have had Gandhi or Abraham Lincoln or anybody.
The breakup was inevitable, it seemed to you.
And it would have been a total disaster because you had 70 years of cultural repression that was ready to erupt at that time, Chechnya being one example.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if Yeltsin's getting the rap of just being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
That's from the perspective of Russians today who think the breakup was a mistake, Jim? Is that what you're conveying?
No. I don't think it was a mistake at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that people are looking back and saying, oh, man, things got really bad in Russia
right.
with Yeltsin. I think they could have been a lot worse, and I just don't know of any person who could have kept that country a little bit more together than what it was at the time.
Or done any better in these tumultuous times. David Remnick, how about it? Could anyone have done better?
I think your caller, Jim, has an excellent point. We've seen chaos and bloodshed on a massive scale in other parts of the world with a lot less history weighing on its shoulders. Your caller is absolutely right to point out that not only was Yeltsin inheriting a politics or lack of politics that had suffered from these 70 years of unbelievably distorting, brutal 70 years of communist rule, Lenin, Stalin, and onward, but also 1,000 years of absolutism. There was really no tradition of either a market economy, except for a very brief period, or democratic liberties to fall back on, as opposed to Poland or Czechoslovakia or the Czech Republic, as it became, or the Baltic states. So right now, if you took a survey, a very fast survey of the former Soviet Union, you could reasonably argue that many places are in some circumstances a lot worse than they were many years ago. But I think you've got to, if you're going to be, it's easy to be critical, and you should be critical of Yeltsin in many ways, or Gorbachev or anybody, or Putin or anybody else. But you have to recognize that a lot of the price being paid is the price of history, whether it's ecological or demographic. The regime that was in place for so long was so had such damage that it only stood to reason that once it was changed or gotten rid of, that there would not be what the communists used to call a svetlaya budushchaya, a shining future immediately around the corner.
Mm.
So I think people could be excused some euphoria for a little while in 1991, but there was a very, very hard price to pay. And Russia and by the way, the former republics of the Soviet Union all each in their own way continue to pay it. And a lot of them are very badly led, or they're highly corrupt.
Huge tides that Boris Yeltsin was riding here. We'll look at some of the details of those. Jim in Des Moines, thanks for your call. David, I want to turn to Moscow for a moment, if I may, to bring another voice in. Masha Lipman, I think you all know each other well. Masha is good. Masha's political analyst at the Carnegie Moscow Center, part of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a columnist for the Washington Post, editor-in-chief of Pro et Contra Journal. It's a Moscow Carnegie Moscow Center publication. Masha Lipman in Moscow, thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
You're here with David Remnick. We're looking back on Boris Yeltsin's role and years and what he left behind. How do you see Russians interpreting this man now? His popularity plummeted in his later years. The Putin government now casting his time, Yeltsin's time, as a time of chaos that they fixed. Is that the popular view of Boris Yeltsin today?
Yes, indeed. This is a very popular view. And I think what Yeltsin yearned for Russia to have was freedom, and he did his best to give freedom to the Russian people. However, the Russian people were very inexperienced with freedom because of the grim history that David mentioned, and they didn't know how to use freedom to make their lives better. In fact, what they expected of Yeltsin is to become their benefactor, to deliver better lives to them. And when he failed to deliver, they condemned him. It is also tradition very much of the 20th century to condemn the previous leader. Whenever there's a new one, however, he emerges on the scene. He starts with condemning his predecessor. Some of the predecessors indeed were monsters, but some were not. And still, what the new era begins with is saying that the previous ruler did everything wrong.
But do Russians not recall that Vladimir Putin was Yeltsin's hand-picked successor?
He was his successor, and he indeed remained loyal to him personally, as he once again proved yesterday when, within hours after the news came of President Yeltsin's death, he said very good and moving words about him and paid tribute to his legacy. However, he basically scrapped the political legacy of President Yeltsin in a way that he pushed Russia back on its historical, traditional path of a state that's omnipotent, whereas the society is impotent.
Masha Lipman joins us from Moscow. She's a political analyst at the Carnegie Moscow Center. David Remnick joins us from New York. He's editor of The New Yorker magazine, was in Moscow as Washington Post correspondent 88 to 92 when Boris Yeltsin was stepping up in a big way that would lead to the dismantling of the Soviet Union. A decade later, Yeltsin was resigning. New Year's Eve, 1999. Here's a portion of that famous resignation speech.
Yeah.
I am leaving. I am stepping down before my time. I understand that I have to do this. Russia must enter the new millennium with new politicians, new faces, and intelligent, strong, and energetic people. Those of us who have been in power for many years must go.
Boris Yeltsin, 1999, saying goodbye to the nation, handing power over to his hand-picked successor, Vladimir Putin. Right now, Charlie's calling from Wakefield, Rhode Island. Charlie, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hey, Tom, I have a comment. I thought that, you know, I see this through the prism of a failure to convert from communist economics to capitalist economics. It seems to me that Yeltsin was more radical in that he tried to push more free market than Gorbachev did.
Mm-hmm.
And that really got him in trouble, that it didn't work. Somehow it just devolved into chaos. And I always thought that the U.S., like, we never really knew how to help them convert to the capitalist economic system. But I'd just like to ask David, or ask you to comment on that. You know, was there a failure there on our part? Do we have any culpability in that? And have we learned anything? If this was to happen again, could we help somebody convert from a communist economic system to a capitalism one without, you know, devolving into that that chaos situation, which I think caused the uprising of Putin.
Not many left to convert, but there's Cuba and a couple more. David Remnick, Masha Lipman, what about it? First, David, was Boris Yeltsin a believer in a kind of magic quality that the abundance he saw in the United States would automatically appear in Russia if they let go of communism? And what about the American role? Did the U.S. step up as it could have, should have?
I think the American role is arguable. When American advisors first got involved a little earlier on, they were mocked as what were they called? Young men in red shorts, or I forget what they were. The Harvard boys. They were all. Mm-hmm. They got plenty of advice. There was no shortage of market economy advice from Jeff Sachs and Goldman Sachs and all the rest. The fact is, the most important element is that that Yeltsin tried to leap across the abyss in one jump, and the main figure behind him was Yegor Gaidar, an extremely smart man, I think of great integrity. But the plan to do this, and it's extremely complex, certainly in the popular view, was corrupt from the start in that huge properties and industries ended up for very, very cheap prices, as it turned out, in the hands of some fairly unscrupulous insiders. And so it was very, very difficult, and especially as inflation increased and certain industries collapsed either of their own accord or for various market reasons or other reasons. And as the GDP declined precipitously, it was very, very difficult, as you would imagine, to keep any popular support for this. And Yeltsin's image, Yeltsin's rating, as a result, plummeted. And so when he was getting ready to run again in 1996, or at least considering it, his popularity ratings were in the single digits.
That's about as low as you can get. Kyla's calling from Oxford, Iowa. Kyla, you're on the air.
Thank you. I think you're underemphasizing the role that the United States played, because the Russians trusted us. They thought that we knew about economics. So then when the Harvard economist, in particular Jeffrey Sachs, said, oh, try tough love, throw everything overboard, start over, it'll be okay, it'll be great. Well, it wasn't great. There's nothing but corruption and mafioso that has taken over. In Moscow and St. Petersburg, it's bad enough, but at least there's enough money rolling around that there's some money that drifts down to ordinary people.
In all due respect, ma'am, Jeffrey Sachs had great success elsewhere, in Poland in particular, but, you know, Russians are not children. I mean, there are a lot of terrific minds and an enormous amount of talent and an unbelievably high literacy rate. And some of the fruits of that are being seen today. I mean, it's not just an oil and gas economy. There's an enormous computer programming economy, and the economic potential of Russia is great. And to have expected that economy to flourish, considering the size and the difficulties of Russia, immediately was probably way too optimistic from the get-go. But Masha Lipman would be much more qualified.
Kyla, let me take your question to Masha in Moscow. Masha Lipman, how about it? The American role in the 90s when Yeltsin was in power, how do Russians see it today? Was it good advice? Was it the right help and aid in making a transition? Was it more than any outside force, even the USA, could be asked to deliver on?
Well, I think it is actually wrong to take the current Russian opinion of the American role back then today to make a good judgment. I think the main problem was the one that David mentioned earlier. The change was so radical, and Jeffrey Sachs may have had success elsewhere, but actually the task that Russia was facing was truly insurmountable. To build a capitalist economy in a country where private property was outlawed for basically seven decades, where private entrepreneurship was a crime for which people went to jail, nobody was trying to tackle this task before, and I don't think there was any good or clean way to deal with it. As to what the earlier listener said about Yeltsin moving too radically, I don't think this is right, because what Yeltsin needed was to radically weakened the communist nomenclatura, the communist elite, and deprived it of its control over property. Otherwise, the communist regime, the communist revenge, would have been absolutely inevitable. So he had, and his advisors were after a very fast redistribution of property so that there would emerge a new power base in Russia, and the communist elite would lose its economic basis. And this was an extremely important task without which no further reforms would be possible. I think it is very wrong to say that there's nothing but corruption in Moscow and St. Petersburg. It's enough to be here to make sure that actually these are two flourishing places, and the higher the oil prices, the more flourishing there is. It's actually unbelievable how these places look these days. We have what is now referred to as middle class, about 20-25% of the Russian population who enjoy a reasonably decent lifestyle. And actually it may be argued that never in the Russian history, in any time under the czars or the commissars, has the proportion of the Russian society enjoying reasonably decent lifestyles has been as high as it is today, largely due to, of course, high energy prices, but this is not the only reason. There is a better structure of the economy today, and even though President Putin wouldn't recognize it, and of course the majority of the Russian public wouldn't, the foundation for this economic development were laid during the 90s.
At the same time, we've got this new authoritarian streak. Let's take a call from Toronto, Canada. Ed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Very interesting program. Russia is in a transition zone. Here they have a new leader, Putin, who is a former KGB head. I saw an interesting program a month ago in Toronto with experts in the U.S., Russia, Canada. And the main comment was they did a poll in the Soviet Union, and what the Soviet people want is authoritarianism and discipline. They really do. They, despite all this thing about democracy, democracy without control is chaotic and leads to insurrection. It's strange. Here we have a leader like Putin, tough. But the big issue here, he's providing the discipline, the transition to a wealthier country, which will bring better lifestyle and more quote unquote democratism. But look what he's done to the journalists. It's so strange. Why execute and be behind the execution of these people who are speaking out against him? Why do that? I mean, I just don't understand that.
Let us pick up both of those, if I may, and thanks very much for your call. David Remnick, I guess let's go to Putin first. Why did Yeltsin select this man above all, and do you think Boris Yeltsin anticipated at the time he did select Putin that he would go as far as he has in rolling back the freedoms that were there in the 90s, as chaotic as that may have been sometime? There's been quite the rollback.
Well, the worst thing you can say in journalism, I guess, is I don't know, or it's hard to say. But I think you have to figure in some measure of uncertainty here. I think what you just played back the tape of Yeltsin's farewell speech, and I'm not sure you can recognize it without Russian. But the speech is slurred. He was exhausted. He was finished, and in fact, he was probably finished a great deal earlier. He rarely appeared in public, and when he did, it was not always with happy results. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he had to be keenly aware that the Russian desire, or any people's desire for that matter, for a semblance of stability and a kind of breather after all these historical push and pull and endless events and endless news, no people thrives on that, least of all Russians. And I think with Putin, he did see somebody with the potential of returning some measure of order. But first and foremost, in Putin, he got a promise of non-prosecution, which was very important to him and to his family for obvious reasons. He had also
obvious, but of course, people may not know that there was widely rumored corruption by Yeltsin himself and money missing,
or at least his family or his circle or in the rest. Mm-hmm. And you know, also, Yeltsin had eaten up a number of potential successors. Remember, he was ruler for quite a long time, and a number of people who would get mentioned either by him or what we call the great mentioner these people would come to the fore and they would in some way be either destroyed or spoiled or discredited. And so he was not left with a hell of a lot of options. But above all, he wanted to make the choice himself. Now, of course, one of the things we do know because of statements that, Yeltsin made, and he made very few statements in his retirement, he was not pleased with the way Putin cracked down on, the press. He was not terribly pleased in the way Putin reinstated certain symbols of Soviet or Russian grandeur, especially Soviet. And I don't think he was pleased by the crackdown on the nascent and ill-formed multi-party system, which now doesn't exist at all. So you now are entering an election season, or no pun intended, a putative election season, with no real opposition in sight, because all opposition, with the exception of a chess player here or a demonstration there, has been pretty much quashed. So these shoots of early democracy, of nascent democracy, have been stamped out underfoot. And I don't think that that's what was part of Yeltsin's mental bargain about the future.
Masha Lippman, how do you see that? Our caller asks about journalists under pressure and some even dead. Of course, Anna Politkovskaya, not so long ago, shot. We've all seen the reports of the harsh crackdown on the press. Why such a harsh crackdown? Is that level of control really necessary for Russia to hold together these days, at least in Putin's view?
First of all, I think your caller probably used the word execution, which is, I think, not the right word to use. And actually,
there was clearly a murder here. The circumstances, well, we're not sure, but everyone looks at it with great skepticism.
Well, I don't think, those journalists were killed by the Kremlin, by the whole chain of command, with Putin giving orders and whole chain of command executing the murders. Actually, the way I see it is quite different. I think it's quite contrary to what one of the callers was talking about. Russia today has stability. What we have today is a very lawless country, with human life being very cheap, with no arbitration being here in sight, with conflicts here and there, petty and big, political and economical and otherwise, being resolved by commissioning contract killers. And I think the journalists who were killed lately are much more likely being the victims of people whose interests they infringed upon. Anna Politkovskaya, who was an extremely devoted and indefatigable advocacy reporter, had so many people who she exposed for violation of human rights and corruption and so on and so forth. She made so many enemies. Any one of them could decide to settle scores with her in this horrible and brutal way. It doesn't take to be the government. We have so many contract killings in the country happening basically every week, high and low, of loyal people, of disloyal people, of people in business and banking, of people in journalism, of people in politics.
Right, an indicator of what's not knit together there yet. Our time grows very short. David Remnick, we've just got a minute here. How do you think history will see this man at this time of gigantic transition over time? How do you expect Boris Yeltsin will be remembered?
Well, I think that he's a figure that has gigantic pluses, and it's quite easy to forget them through the tunnel of time. What he accomplished in terms of forcing Gorbachev's hand, in a sense, forcing the pace of reform in the late 80s, and then his act in 1991 is of to me real historical heroism. The rest of the record is extremely mixed, but I think Masha, who's such an intelligent voice on this, is right to point out that it's hard to imagine any leader, Gorbachev, Yeltsin, anybody coming along who would not have had a mixed record. There's also the inexcusable when it comes to Chechnya and certain other acts, and also the kind of court politics that came to infect Russian politics. Yeltsin let that happen through, for a variety of reasons of weakness and health.
The body lies in state today. The funeral is tomorrow. David Remnick, editor at The New Yorker, Pulitzer Prize winner, thank you so much for being with us. And Masha Lippman at the Carnegie Moscow Center, thank you as well. This is On Point.